This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Tim Stenovic. Carol Messer is off this week. Coming up on the show, we're going to hear from venture capitalist Kai-Fu Lee, chairman and CEO of Sinovation Ventures, on his new fiction book, AI 2041, 10 Visions for Our Future. We're also going to take a look at what impact an infrastructure bill could have on cryptocurrencies, plus how Peter Thiel games tech, Trump, and the IRS to make billions, all tax-free. It's this week's cover story. All of that to come, but we begin with Bloomberg Business Week's annual ranking of best business schools. It's the best B schools 2021 and 2022, and perhaps not a surprise at the one that comes out on top. Katie Greifeld and I spoke with the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber, also Bloomberg's managing editor for diversity. Do we do a drum roll, Joel?
Why not?
Okay.
I mean,
drum roll.
Stanford. Repeat.
Not coming as a surprise to anyone who follows business schools closely, I think.
Well, and it has been one that we've had them at the top before. They've been knocked off the top before, but they are back on top. Another one that has been kind of a sleeper and has repeatedly shown up in our rankings is Dartmouth's mm-hmm. Tuck. They came in number two, and then Harvard at number three to round out the top three. Business Week has long been known for its business school ranking, 30 plus years that we've been doing this. And I think the thing that we've really doubled down on and props to Caleb Solomon, who's been one of the main architects of this, is we've really like leaned into the data and the surveys. We talked to hundreds and hundreds of students and let that inform so much of what ends up being part of the ranking.
Alumni too?
Alumni is a huge part of it. And then this year, which is, I think, really exciting, and I can happily share the mic here, is that we're always looking for ways that we can make this ranking be more full-throated even. And this is an example of it. We've added a significant amount of diversity into that. So Jeff, let's bring you in. How did you grapple with that and all the articles and stuff that you got to write in accompanying the ranking?
Well, it's kind of interesting. There's sort of two things going on at the top level, sort of the macro look. B schools are surprisingly not diverse, I guess, or not surprisingly. They kind of mimic what you see in the C-suite. In terms of, but when you look at college overall and graduate school overall, it tends to be 60-40 women to men. And when you look at B school, it's flipped, where women are still in the minority. Mm-hmm. And with gender, I mean, with race and ethnicity, you still see the applicants lagging where they would be in the population based on where they're in the schools, which is, that's more of a universal truth across all education. But it was interesting kind of look at what's working and how different the rankings are when you compare the best schools for diversity to the best schools in the ranking. Your top three schools were not in the top 10 of the ranking that I was writing about. They were, however, in the top 20.
So, Jeff, when it comes to diversity, for the universities that aren't doing so well in terms of the diversity of their student bodies, do they seem concerned about it? Are there efforts underway at these universities and colleges to improve on their diversity measures?
Yeah, I mean, I actually went out of my way to interview the last place school, BYU. And, you know, even there, just in this their last sort of round of employee reviews, every employee at the biz school has to say, what did you do in the last year to improve diversity? And what are you going to do in the next year? And they have a checklist of all the kinds of things they consider, like three pages of things they could be doing depending on their job in various aspects of the university, recognizing that they can't just say, you know, that's not our thing or whatever. Nobody says, just as nobody says in corporate America, yeah, diversity is not really our priority. It's clearly top of mind, particularly in the last year and a half.
Jeff, you're managing diversity reporter. We've gotten to talk to you a lot here on Bloomberg Business Week Radio and at Bloomberg Quick Take about the way that the C-suite is or is not diversifying, the way that diversity efforts are or are not working at America's publicly traded companies. Who's doing a better job, U.S. companies or U.S. business schools?
when it comes to big U.S. companies versus big U.S. MBA programs, definitely big U.S. companies. But okay. I think the pressure's differently, different. I mean, the top 100 companies in the S&P, you know, can't hide. And they're under, like, really direct pressure to do something different. And they're the top 100 companies, and people want to work there. It's an easier sell. Where I think there's some issues in the way that enrollment works and how people come into colleges, into business school, that kind of that restrict the pipeline, and to some degree is maybe even more challenging, unfortunately, in the MBA world than it is in the corporate world. But I would like to say one of the things I found really interesting that is a really big opportunity that corporate America should be looking at is a lot of these programs are like 100 students or less. And if you have a program that has 100 students or less and it comes anywhere near reflecting the diversity of America, this is a great laboratory for even majority executives to learn about what the future holds for business. So you should really be looking at the graduates from these smaller schools who are in diverse programs as maybe somebody who's kind of been there, done that, where if you get to one of the big schools with 1,000 students, you can still kind of stick to your own.
That's Bloomberg's Jeff Green and Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, we're going to look at crypto banking with the CEO of Vast Bank. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Walmart and a press release distributor are investigating a hoax tying the retailer to a supposed cryptocurrency deal after an announcement later determined to be false. That caused a surge in Litecoin. For more on this and all things cryptocurrencies, I, along with Bloomberg's Kriti Gupta, spoke with Brad Scrivener, the CEO of Vast Bank. It's the first bank in the country to offer crypto banking. Brad, what went through your mind earlier this week when you saw those headlines?
You know, when you see things like that, you know that crypto has certainly arrived, right? I mean, for it to pop up on the headlines like that. And, you know, we are a national bank. We're highly regulated. We're going to do the right things. And, you know, for us, I feel good to be positioned where we are. Knowing that, like I said, we're going to do the right things when it comes to the crypto markets.
But I do, Brad, wonder if it, you know, there's this fight for legitimacy, I think, when it comes to the crypto community. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it certainly seems like that fight is continuing. And I'm wondering if this type of thing sets that fight for legitimacy back.
I think you're hitting on a really key point here. And some of the research shows this, right? There are those crypto curious out there. There are those institutions out there. And what they're looking for is some certainty. They're looking for the things that here in the United States that we have, which is, you know, a legal way to participate in these types of things. So that's why, as a national bank, I think this is a really good thing. Those folks that are crypto curious, they would like to participate, but they're just not going to go out there and open up an account with someone that they may not know. You know, we've been around for 39 years, highly regulated from the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. And I think it's things like that that are going to give institutions and individuals greater confidence to be able to come into the market to the extent that they want to.
Well, Brad, that's interesting that you mentioned that there is this kind of desire for people to use this more broadly. But what's it going to take to get that kind of normalcy that perhaps the dollar, that gold, that other currencies really have here at a time when you do actually have some major companies, PayPal, Venmo, Tesla, that have come out and actually supported the currency? Overstock is another one. So what is it going to take? Who do you need the bid from?
Judging from the reaction that we've had since our announcement, you know, as the first national bank to come out with this capability to purchase directly from your account, okay, up to 8 current cryptocurrencies. So I think folks are out there looking for certainty. And we had people contacting us saying, hey, we want to participate, but we were waiting for a national bank to get involved because there's this expectation that we are highly regulated, We do have people that are reviewing us regularly and in terms of our regulators. So I think this is a really, really good first step. And when the OCC came out with the interpretive letter that said that this was an acceptable activity, meaning custody of crypto assets, you know, that was a really good first step. And I think it's good for our country to bring this into a regulated manner, and people will have greater confidence.
Brad, let me follow that up with asking about the bank specifically. How exposed is the bank specifically to crypto as opposed to simply through your clients?
Well, when you say exposed to crypto, we do not bring on crypto assets directly onto our balance sheet. So there would be no exposure in terms of safety and soundness like that. I've used this analogy before. Think about, you know, what's going on like a safe deposit box, right? Everybody's familiar with that inside of your bank. Well, that's the equivalent of like the digital wallet. And those digital currencies inside of that safe deposit box are yours, just like if you are storing, you know, jewelry or whatever the case may be inside of a safe deposit box. So the value of that going up and down, that is the customer's responsibility to understand those pieces. But the bank directly is not exposed to that volatility.
The bank has been around since 1982. So it's not new, even though many people listening right now probably haven't heard of it because it is a local bank. I'm wondering, as the CEO of the company, how you're thinking about turning this bank's local profile into a national profile as you adopt cryptocurrency.
Yeah, so we're a family-owned bank, like you say, been around 39 years. And at the end of the day, we know customer preferences have continued to change. Technology has changed rapidly. So we knew we needed to be able to remain relevant to those ever-changing customer needs. And we had a partnership that we put in place starting in 2018 with SAP. So we became the first bank in the country to do the SAP banking services starting then. And then in 2020, when Mr. Brooks and the OCC made the announcement that under our charter, national banks could custody crypto assets, we were positioned with a technology stack that enabled us to pivot and then be able to bring forward the custody of these digital assets.
I'm wondering right now what portion of your bank is made up of people doing, you know, quote unquote, traditional banking, not involving cryptocurrencies, versus people who do crypto banking.
Yeah, so we've had a really strong uptake. We are in all 50 states. In terms of the digital asset side with the bank, also in the territories, Puerto Rico, Guam, and D.C., and we've only been at this for 2 weeks. So we feel Wow. really good about that. Now, obviously, from a revenue standpoint, the traditional bank still dominates that side of the revenue stream. But we're very pleased with the folks that have come on. And, you know, it's in the app stores right now. So App Store, Google Play, you can go download it and basically within 5 minutes be ready to go.
Where are you seeing the interest coming from geographically here in the U.S.? Where are most people signing up from?
You know, we're California, New York, Texas, Oklahoma. Clearly, that's our backyard. And Florida would be the top five from memory right now. We've got a real-time reporting system that shows us as people. You know, in fact, if you guys wanted to sign up right now, I could see it as you came on.
Which cryptocurrencies are you seeing as the most popular in your accounts?
Bitcoin has been the top one, Ethereum, and then Cardano. I believe I heard Litecoin earlier with the Walmart announcement. That's one of them as well.
Right, the one didn't end up being. We should note it wasn't a real announcement.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the fake announcement.
Yeah,
thank you. Right. Yeah. So Filecoin, Orchid, Algorand, and Bitcoin Cash. Those are the, I think I named the eight.
That was Brad Scrivener, the CEO of Vast Bank. Still ahead on Bloomberg Business Week, we stay in the crypto space and look at how the infrastructure bill could impact digital currencies. This is Bloomberg.
broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
One way that lawmakers propose to pay for the $1 trillion infrastructure bill that the Senate approved last month is by imposing tax reporting requirements for cryptocurrency brokers, the same way stockbrokers report its customer sales to the IRS. It could open the way for tighter regulation in the crypto space. It's something that the Biden administration is moving toward, as it also pushes for tax compliance. For more, I, along with a Bloomberg Quick Take and Bloomberg News cross-asset reporter Katie Greifeld, spoke with Danelle Dixon. She's the CEO and executive director at Stellar Development Foundation. Danelle, this was a contentious part of the infrastructure bill. What's your takeaway here?
Yeah, it certainly became so. It was really fun for us to see the influence that we could have from the blockchain and crypto space, and for us just to really engage with policymakers. But in the end, I mean, the language is what the language is, so it didn't change. But it was really fun to be able to engage and to try to really create that educational opportunity around with these policymakers.
And so, Danelle, this bill, I know it was roundly criticized by the crypto industry for being too broad. Can you walk us through exactly what was the language that got crypto advocates so upset? I mean, what was the biggest point of contention there?
Yeah, so I think it was the definition of broker. So that it was defined as any person who, for consideration, is responsible for regularly providing any service effectuating transfers of digital assets on behalf of another person. And so the argument and the concern was that there are many players in the space that run, for example, validators that just validate transactions on working on blockchains, but they don't actually have access to any information that traditional brokers would, and they don't act as brokers. So there was just concern that this was very, very broad language with technology that's very new and maybe not widely understood.
If you could write the regulation or write the legislation, what would you want it to say?
It's a great question. I think that the regulation itself should just have exclusions in it at the very least to talk about, to think about blockchain more itself as infrastructure and think about these providers that are allowing and helping these transactions just to progress, that they actually are excluded from the bill. For example, like validators and folks who run nodes. There was language that was proposed that we were comfortable with, and that we actually, you know, that it didn't ultimately make it through, but it would really just be excluding and making clear that it's not actually trying to go after these true infrastructure providers that are just helping blockchain to operate.
And so we've seen some efforts to try to change the language. Last month, there actually was an amendment that would change the reporting rules, but that was blocked by the Senate. So I'm curious, what's the path forward from here?
Well, I think that this actually created a really great opportunity for us because it showed that, first of all, there is this large constituency that policymakers are willing to engage with and listen to. And I think that the path forward is to create those open dialogues before you get to the language of a bill. I think that it's crucial to engage with lawmakers to discuss the use cases and the roles for different participants. And that's bringing industry experts and policymakers together. And so that's what we're really focused on doing now.
Which policymakers can you single out for us that really seem to get it?
Well, I think that there are many. I can't single out any particular we actually had some that supported language that we wanted to bring to the table. But most importantly, I think it's that when you actually understand how the technology operates and what we're trying to do here, I think that, you know, you'll understand that the definition of broker doesn't and shouldn't cover some of these players that don't have access to that type of information and frankly have no relationship to any of the participants who are making these transactions. So I think it's really all of the senators and the members of the House that we need to really engage with, but it's also the regulatory agencies that we're really focused on participating with and engaging with. I think some of them understand what the technology does, but they don't have a knowledge of what the use cases can do and what it can and the value that can bring to their constituents. So it's a lot of work for us to do in the U.S., but I think it's actually really good work. And I think that, you know, once we demonstrate that excluding their own constituents from this really useful and valuable services that are offered through blockchain, they're going to want to be a part of it, and we're going to be able to help them to get there.
And so, Danielle, stepping back a little bit, it definitely feels over the past few months that regulators have started to circle crypto, whether it's the U.S. Congress with the infrastructure bill or just the SEC this week cracking down on Coinbase and really investigating their proposed lending product. I'm curious, what do you think is on the radar next? And we have just about 30 seconds here.
A lot of focus right now is on the decentralized finance space. And so I think that we're going to see, we just have to provide a lot more education around that. I want us to be able to demonstrate the value of this technology neutral opportunity that we have that's made in the open and valuable to everyone. I think we need to focus on a lot of different areas, but that's, I think, the next target space.
That's Danielle Dixon, the CEO of Stellar Development Foundation. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. And coming up next, you may know Kai-Fu Lee as the chairman, CEO, and founder of the VC firm Sinovation Ventures, but he's also an author of Fiction. He's going to tell you all about his new book, AI 2041. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Kai-Fu Lee has spent nearly 40 years at the forefront of artificial intelligence. He's the chairman, CEO, and co-founder of Sinovation Ventures. It's a venture capital firm with about $2.5 billion in assets. It focuses on AI, healthcare, and other high tech, and has made more than 300 investments. It's one of the first Chinese VC firms to have a presence in the U.S., and he's also the co-chair of the Artificial Intelligence Council at the World Economic Forum. He's the former president of Google China, and before that was an executive at Microsoft and at Apple. His newest book is AI 2041, 10 Visions for Our Future. And unlike his last book, AI 2041, it's a work of fiction. He and his co-author, the sci-fi novelist Chen Chou-Fen, write 10 stories. They're all set 20 years from now. In 1041. Now, these stories illustrate a world that's layered with artificial intelligence. They cover themes like AI displacing workers, deepfakes, and how AI will reimagine education. Of course, also imagines what could go wrong. Kai-Fu Lee joins us now from Beijing. Kai-Fu, great to chat with you. Thanks so much for taking the time. Why are these stories? Why is sci-fi? Why is it the best way to communicate what you envision AI doing to society in 20 years?
AI is such an important technology, perhaps the most important in the history of mankind. And yet it's sometimes viewed as rocket science, very hard to understand. So I wanted to see if there's a way to make it accessible to people and that it's actually not only understandable, but also fun to read. That's why I found a science fiction writer to work with me. He writes the stories, I write the analysis, and then we make sure that the stories are realistic within a 20-year time frame so that the stories you read will be roughly what life will be like 20 years from now.
Do you think the companies that deploy AI today that are working on solving these issues, do you think they're taking into account the pitfalls, the perils that you associate with AI?
I think they are trying, but because it's a new technology, so the tools to combat the problems aren't there yet. And the engineers building the products weren't aware of the problems. None of the problems were intentionally created, you know, issues with respect to personal data and explainability and what happens when AI makes a mistake and accountability and also bias. So these were not intentional by the companies or the engineers who built it. But now that we know these are real problems, we need to put the training, the regulations, and investigating new technologies to combat technology problems.
Do you think the incentives, though, are aligned for companies that do work on this type of technology to create solutions, or are they mainly concerned with us getting to buy more, to engage more, to read more, to spend more time on the platform without being concerned about the consequences?
It is exactly because the incentives are not aligned. So I think the only way to fix it is to realign the incentives. And in the short term, the internet companies could have an incentive realignment if there were either regulations or third parties that may do an AI audit, or maybe there would be watchdog functions that are estimating percentage of fake news and things like that, that forces them before their brand and reputation to consider that, because if they lose their brand and have a some kind of a media disaster, they will lose customers. So that would is one way to externally force an approximation to an alignment. But there are also other ways. Why can we not encourage building of applications and products that help us in the long term? So if there were a product that could make me more intelligent, more knowledgeable, more wealthy, more happier, then that would be a product I would want to buy more than I would want the Facebook newsfeed or YouTube. So I think there are ways to align user interest. I think people just, the companies just felt like they got such a good AI tool, it can make money directly, so use it for that singular purpose. And forget really that companies should be focused on user needs first, and users want more than just watching some videos and reading some blogs. There are long-term goals that we have, and when we have such a powerful AI tool that can optimize our long-term goals, it would be such a unfortunate event if nobody tried to build something that's for our long-term interest.
So let's stick with Facebook because it's one of the companies that you mentioned. So who should regulate Facebook? Should it be the U.S. government, or should there be some sort of international body that takes these difficult questions into account to come up with some regulatory framework? After all, for all intents and purposes, Facebook is a global company.
Right, right. I'm not an expert in regulation. And I think regulation, in my opinion, is just usually the last resort. Because especially given the tools that the U.S. has generally used, such as breaking a company up, that's just too brittle. So I think there needs to be ways to push the company into an alignment with the goals that we, the users, have. And I mentioned a few of them. You know, when I worked for Google, there were third parties that measured the relevance quality of Google search engine, and Google paid a lot of attention to that. So if there could be similar third-party watchdog measures of level of fake news, number of deep fakes, and how much spam, and then it's measured externally, that would put a pressure on the engineering team to figure out at least to spend part of their time to make the content higher quality instead of just getting us to click more and more.
So Kai-Fu, let's take a step back and just think about how we interact with AI in 2021. Just take us through, because I think that there are a lot of people who don't necessarily think about it each and every day that we are interacting with this technology. We are experiencing this technology. So what does it look like for in our daily lives globally in 2021?
So one example is that AI's language capabilities to converse with us will grow significantly, in many cases indistinguishable from human-human communication. And that means AI will become a companion, and that companion can learn our interests and try to help us improve ourselves. That would be an educational companion, or to figure out how we might be healthier. That might be more of a doctor or psychiatrist companion, or it could just be a friend, a pal for a young kid. And they can take shapes in both in the phone and the computer, of course, but also VR and AR will be really realistic by then, that if we put on something like glasses, we will see figures and avatars superimposed on the glasses. And then they're it's as though they were in the actual environment. So it would be really virtual reality that's indistinguishable from the real reality. In transportation, autonomous vehicles should just about work by then, get all the kinks worked out. Of course, throughout the way, we will see incrementally robo buses and shuttles and trucks and so on. But truly the steering wheel-free car that we can either share, ride, or buy will be just about 15 to 20 years from now. That will dramatically change our habits because we will have something like 10 hours a week freed up that when we're in the car, we can educate, entertain, communicate, no longer have to drive or look at the road. Also, cars can be on demand, available, and they will be smart. They will talk to each other. They will avoid accidents. They will miss each other by 1 centimeter in a very calculated way. They will drive more safely, probably eventually reducing fatalities by 90%. So it'll be more efficient, lower cost, save us time, more comfortable, and also safer. And finally, in healthcare, AI will be able to, with a very high likelihood, predict the next pandemic. Because it could be watching a lot of data all over the world. And AI will be used to, alongside with scientists, invent new drugs. And that the cost of new drugs probably could be as little as 10% of new drug inventions today. And what that means is today's pharmaceuticals can only go after blockbuster drugs for common diseases. But in the future, when the cost is slashed, because AI is proposing treatments that are highly accurate, working with scientists, reducing the cost by 90%, that means rare diseases for which it's not economical for pharmaceuticals to go after will become possible. And also AI will be keeping us healthy by taking all of our MRI and gene sequencing and blood to regularly monitor our health and give us hints on how to be healthier and live longer, and both of which will happen in 20 years.
That's Kai-Fu Lee, chairman and CEO of Sinovation Ventures, also the author of the new fiction book AI 2041, 10 Visions for Our Future. That wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Tim Stenovic. Coming up in our next hour, a new book describes how we can end climate change in one generation. We're going to hear from the author. And in our pursuits section, COVID-19 has kickstarted a resurgence in golf real estate. Plus, how Peter Thiel gamed tech, Trump, and the IRS to make billions, all tax-free. It's this week's cover story. All that to come. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hello, I'm Tim Stenovic. Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including how one company is looking to make a whole woman, whole life healthcare model. We're going to hear from the CEO. Plus, a new book examines how we can end the climate crisis in one generation. And in our pursuit section, how a house made of bread, yes, bread, is one of the highlights of this year's Art Basel. It's going to cost you millions of dollars if you want it. We begin this hour, though, with the magazine's cover story. For more details, we turn to Bloomberg's Katie Greifeld, also my Business Week co-host, Carol Masser.
Well, a Bloomberg exclusive. It's also the Bloomberg Business Week cover story. It's about Peter Thiel, you know, the Silicon Valley billionaire investor and disruptor. Turns out he's kind of just like all the other rich folks out there. So writes Max Chafkin in his new biography of Thiel. Let's get more on this. Bloomberg Business Week editor Joel Weber, along with Bloomberg U.S. Technology Managing Editor Mark Millian, he is on the phone in our New York City bureau. Peter Thiel, we've talked about him a lot and his relationship. Interesting one with Trump.
The cover story this week begins this meeting in Trump Tower right in the transition period after Trump had been elected, where Peter Thiel, who you may recall was on stage at the Republican National Convention just a couple weeks before that, months before that, and basically he was able to bring a bunch of tech CEOs to Trump and basically be this bridge between tech and the recently elected president in a way that was somewhat unexpected. And it speaks to the power that Thiel wields in Silicon Valley. Like, obviously, he's been real integral part of this PayPal mafia for years, first outside investor in Facebook. And there's a lot of roads in Silicon Valley that lead to Peter Thiel. And what's interesting was this sort of little marriage that happened between Trump and Thiel. And that proved not great for a lot of people in Trump's circle. And it seemed to have worked out really well for Peter Thiel, who we think more than doubled his fortune during that time.
Mark, I want to bring you into this conversation because what's been really wonderful throughout the Trump presidency and thereafter is, you know, exploring these relationships that the former president had with some likely subjects and some unlikely subjects. And Peter Thiel seems to fall into that category.
Yes, I would definitely agree with that. And one of the
despite holding
unlikely
hands at that meeting at Trump Tower.
That is a stark image, the bro hand-holding love fest they had there. But Thiel is a longtime technologist from Silicon Valley, foreign-born, gay. I mean, there are a lot of things about his background that would suggest that he would not be part of the MAGA contingent. And yet he is a contrarian investor above all else, and he's made a lot of bad bets over the years, but he's made some fantastic ones. Facebook is certainly in that camp, and I think Trump is in that camp.
Yeah, Mark, that's what I want to dig into because, I mean, like you said, this is what Thiel does. I mean, he's a venture capitalist. His whole thing is finding, you know, startups to invest in. I mean, how much is there a parallel to draw between his MO when it comes to, you know, investing, being a venture capitalist, and this kind of unlikely relationship he forged with Donald Trump?
I think there's a direct line. I think his entire investment strategy is a reflection of the title of Max's book, which is contrarian. I mean, he looks at where the popular opinions are and where the winds are blowing, and he goes the opposite direction. And oftentimes that doesn't work. Max chronicles in the book his hedge fund Clarium Capital, which was like very early to seeing the housing crisis, but in fact was too early and just went so far down this contrarian path that it led to disaster. And so this strategy is not foolproof, but when you nail it, I mean, it can really pay off. And I think Trump was an example of where he saw it early and he went in pretty big, and it did pay off in some ways.
Matt, as you go through, you know, Max's book and this excerpt, which is the cover story, again, like you say, that picture of the two of them holding hands. I mean, I think for a long time early on, we were all just trying to make sense of this relationship. But in the end, Peter Thiel benefited big time.
Yes, he certainly did. I mean, not to the extent maybe he envisioned in his wildest imaginations of sort of remaking government in his image. You know, Max, this excerpt goes into some detail about how he offered, you know, a long list of picks for various administrative positions that the campaign deemed too extreme.
Which is something.
Yeah. It really says something for sure.
But, you know, the other thing that I think is important, and this is sort of where Max's excerpt culminates, and I think it's one of the reasons that this biography by Max Chefkin, as I mentioned, out next week, is so important, is that what we're really going to be watching here is Peter Thiel's a transition from being a Silicon Valley power broker to something that maybe is more about the GOP and politics going forward. And that will play out in midterms first and foremost.
Really good point. This story cover on the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week, which is available. Bloomberg Business Week, of course, and that's Max Chafkin's book, The Contrarian. We're going to be talking to Max next week. Joel and Mark, thanks.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, a new book looks at how to end the climate crisis in one generation. We're going to hear from the author. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Tim Stenovic with Katie Greifeld.
Well, Katie, I think a lot of people feel powerless when it comes to addressing the climate crisis. And they do see stories about what's happening to the world, and they say, well, I can try to recycle, I can try to drive less, but ultimately, what can I do? That's something that our next guest, Paul Hawken, tries to address in his latest book, Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. Paul Hawken is an environmentalist and author. He's an entrepreneur. He's an activist. He's dedicated his life to environmental sustainability and changing the relationship between business and the environment. And he joins us now on the phone from the San Francisco Bay Area. Paul, it's really great to have you on the show. Congratulations on your most recent book, Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. How do we do it? How do we get to the point where we don't feel powerless?
Well, I think we feel powerless, and thank you very much for inviting me onto the program. We feel powerless because of what is being told to us. And the climate narrative, if we can call it that, has been for quite a long time, from the science point of view, which is a future existential threat, and if we don't do this, things are going to get worse. And it's great science, and they've been absolutely spot on in terms of their predictions. And then what happened is that a tactic that was really adopted from tobacco, which was taken up by British Petroleum, and there was individuated the problem, which is that we just drill, you know, oil wells and sell gas. You can calculate your carbon footprint, you know, as if you can solve the problem, you know. And so, yeah, you can drive less, get a bike, recycle, use cold water in your washing machine, put power strips in your home entertainment center. These are some of the solutions that are coming out, you know. And what happened is individuals would listen to that and understand that that made sense. It did lower impact. But unless you had, you know, IQ lower than room temperature, you knew that they were completely inadequate to the task at hand because you were reading the headlines, you know.
Right. It's like sustainability theater, right?
Yeah. It's like, you know, and it makes you feel disempowered. As an individual, go, oh, man, this is worse than I thought. And so... And then people then turn to big government, you know, government is big by de facto, but I mean government, and just say, well, you know, you should do something, you know, but there's only certain things government can do, and they should, and they're not, and they haven't been, but that's, so I'm for that, but government is the slowest institution to move, not the fastest. Then people feel like, well, if they think that the only thing that can happen is between the individual, the individuated individual, he, she, by himself, herself, and then government in its enormity. And what regeneration talks about is actually the gold, the juice, is in them between those two. Mm. You know, it's not the two opposites at all.
Where do we go from here? Because at the individual level, there's frustration. Like you say, government can be slow to move. How do we ultimately get started and fix this?
Two things. One is, right now, there's no difference between a climate denier and somebody who understands the problem and does nothing. From the Earth's point of view, they're the same people, you know.
Wow.
And so you have 40, 50% of people who understand it and who are doing nothing. You have 98% of the world just disengaged. And no matter how you see this, you can't read the science and not understand that this is the greatest crisis humanity has ever faced and probably will, you know, when you think about it. And so how to become disengaged? And that's your question in reverse, you know, which is how do we become engaged? And the way we do it is we talk about it in a very different way. And we talk about possibilities instead of probabilities, number one. Number two, the rhetoric that came out of science, which was good, which is about existential threat, which occasioned fear, activists took that over, got to science, then they blamed, shamed, you know, and pointed fingers and so forth. You know, you're the cause, you're the problem, Exxon, you're it, you know, so forth.
Right.
And then you then communicate to people with fear, threat, you know, shame, blame, you know, finger pointing and, you know, calving glaciers. And,
right.
And then you expect them to do something, they're gone. Well, they're off. That channel has been turned off.
And so, Paul, let's talk about the regeneration process, because I'm looking at page 249 of your book. You've laid out a few guidelines. I mean, what principles should people be keeping in mind as, you know, they try to regenerate, which, like you lay out, our bodies are doing every day, every minute?
Well, the first principle is to understand just a working definition, which is mine, and you can do it yourself, you know, your own definition, but mine is to put life at the center of every act and decision. In other words, does this harm life or does it increase life?
You know, I think about it from the perspective of, you know, what I'm going to do for dinner tonight, right?
Sure.
I think we're going to order pizza.
Yeah.
Does that harm, you know, it's going to be delivered to us.
How?
In a bicycle.
There you go.
which I guess is good.
Yeah.
You know, but does that harm life? Or does it reduce life? Does it help? Should I have gone to the grocery store? Should I not have ordered groceries online? Should I go walk by foot to get groceries? I mean, there are all these questions that we can try to answer with that checklist every day, sure. And we don't necessarily know the answers to them.
Of course not. Let's just turn the question around and say, do you want to degenerate life on Earth? I don't think so. That's not your purpose. That's not why you're here. And that's what the entire economic sector does. It extracts life. If you just go down any supply chain, you'll find when you get to it, not very far, that it is taking life itself, you know, removing it, killing it, you know. And the fact is that that's degeneration. So the book is saying, well, that road doesn't go much further. We can see the end of that. That's ocean acidification. That is extreme weather. That is fires we can't even put out, you know, not just the fires, not just the northern hemisphere is on fire. We don't even know how to put the fire out anymore. They're so big. And so we can see, like, do we still want to go down that road any further? I don't think so. So regeneration is just a 180. It's a pivot. And it is step by step, bit by bit. But at least the question is there. For example, you could, like, does it or does it not? And does it create more life or reduce it? Does it, most importantly, does it steal the future or does it heal it? And we have this idea that the world economic system works the way it does and makes so much money for so many people, blah, 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 because it works. Well, yes, and it is also stealing our future. If it wasn't stealing our future, there wouldn't be all these headlines about what's happening to the environment, to Earth, to people, etc. And so we pose the question as, what would it look like to have an economy that heals the future? That would be a GDP, too. Mm. That would be revenues, too. And that would be companies as well. But very, very different orientation. And it is a question, but you have companies, the biggest food company in the world is Nestle, and they announced that their motto going ahead is generation, regeneration. And they're taking it very seriously about, okay, we need to pivot
right.
to regenerative agricultural systems if we're going to continue to exist as a company, as a food company, in this world, in this earth, at this time.
That's author Paul Hawken on his new book, Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. And still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, the CEO of TIA on raising new funds to create a whole women, whole life healthcare model. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
We've talked a lot about health tech over the past year as the pandemic and lockdown quickly forced people to start doing virtual visits and change the way that they think about their health. Carolyn Witte is the co-founder and CEO of TIA. It's a company that just raised $100 million in Series B funding to create a whole women, whole life healthcare model. Joined by Bloomberg's Katie Greifeld, we caught up with Carolyn and she described her company.
So zooming out, TIA is creating a fundamentally new paradigm for modern women's healthcare. And what that means is we are a healthcare provider at the core who delivers comprehensive healthcare to women online and offline that supports women's whole health needs, mental, physical, and emotional, and supports them throughout their lives from puberty to menopause.
When people think of women's health, they mostly think of reproductive health, but how do you move beyond that?
You're exactly right. I think part of the challenge that TIA has faced over the last 4 years of building this company is a mental model shift. Redefining fundamentally what is women's health from beyond the body part or life stage, pregnancy, fertility, menopause, to care for 51% of the population. And that's really what TIA is all about. And there's a reason for this. We know that while pregnancy is a very, very critical and important journey in a woman's life, one that TIA is investing in to support through our integrative care model, there are many, many other needs that women have that are all too often ignored that fall outside of your reproductive organs. We know that cardiovascular disease is the number one killer of women. We know that women are diagnosed with anxiety and depression at 2 to 3 times the rate of men. There are so many issues facing women. We are not body parts, but whole people. And it's time that the healthcare system was built for us to serve us in all of our needs.
Carolyn, as far as membership options go, you offer a $15 per month membership or an annual $150 a year. How does insurance play into this? And is the cost of an actual appointment supplemental to that membership fee?
Yeah, so TIA is a membership-based women's healthcare practice. What this means is women don't use TIA, but they join TIA. And it's more of a community-driven care model. Your membership fee covers benefits that go beyond what a typical doctor's office or insurance covers, chiefly things like care coordination, community events, seamless access to same-day bookings, referrals, and so forth. Once you are a member of TIA, the price of which most women pay for Spotify and Netflix each month, you can actually use your insurance for all of our services, from primary care to acupuncture to mental health and gynecology. And so we're really proud that we help women really squeeze the sponge out of their insurance benefits to get the preventative health care that we know that all women need and deserve.
And so, Carolyn, I want to talk more about your latest funding round, $100 million. That is one of the largest Series B investments ever for a woman-led healthcare startup. What does TIA plan to do with that money?
We're going to do three core things. First is scale our whole woman, whole life care model to more women in more places. Today, TIA is live in three markets, New York City, Los Angeles, and Phoenix, and we'll be launching in San Francisco and across the Bay Area later this year. So we'll be opening a lot more clinics in those markets and rolling out new markets as well, with the goal of opening 15 clinics next year and serving 100,000 women across our virtual and in-person care platform by the end of 2023. The second thing we're doing is rolling out additional services that better support women throughout their lives, from puberty to menopause, with a specific focus on the pregnancy journey, deeply investing in the preconception and postpartum care parts of this journey that are underinvested in, where we think TIA can have the biggest impact. And the third area is continuing to strike strategic partnerships with the leading health systems in every market in which we operate. Health system partnerships, like our partnership with Common Spirit in Arizona, is really critical to enabling TIA to provide continuous care, not only within TIA's four walls, but across outpatient to inpatient care through the obstetrical journey, labor and delivery, NICU, and so forth. We're able to provide a higher quality, more easily accessible experience by partnering with health systems.
Carolyn, just in the last 40 seconds that we have with you, every story right now is a labor story. And I want to know the struggle or ease you have had in attracting providers, doctors to the platform.
Yes. So one of the things that make TIA really distinct is the way we actually hire, train, vet our providers. Unlike other virtual-only players, we are not a network or marketplace model, but actually employ all of our clinicians, which is really key for integration of services, clinical quality, and a continuous relationship-based care experience that we deliver to all of our patients. So we believe TIA's model, a full-stack platform model, many say technology, brand, experience, clinical practice, is really the right way to truly overhaul everything about healthcare it delivers, and do it in a higher quality, lower cost way.
That's Carolyn Witte, the CEO of TIA. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, we take you through this week's pursuit section, from golf course living to a house made of bread. It's the stories you definitely do not want to miss. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
We head to the back of the book now with the magazine's Pursuit section. And joining me now is Chris Rauser, editor of the Pursuit section for Bloomberg Business Week. Chris, a handful of different subjects in the Pursuit section in this week's magazine. What is the common thread that ties together a house of bread, a new hotel in Paris, and living on the golf course?
You know, it's all different kinds of ways that you could possibly live your life. it's all about structures and shelter. Our section opens this week with a new trend, which is that people in houses and home communities around golf courses are actually really selling out like crazy ever since the pandemic started. And this was a trend that was actually not going well before the pandemic. There was a big boom in the 2000s of building basically too many houses inside golf clubs.
And golf course developers had to essentially donate some of the unused golf courses to parks.
Yes, exactly.
People,
there were hundreds
golfing.
Of clubs in the 90s and 2000s were shut down, actually, because there was too many. They had built too many. And now, because people want to have a little privacy, live in a private community. These courses are actually really selling through, and some of them are quite expensive and quite lavish.
Yeah. For example, in Hawaii, a home that is 4-bedroom, 4.5 baths runs you $5.6 million. Geographically, they're all over the country. South Carolina, you have one available, or you talk about one that's available, a new community available in about 90 minutes from New York City, too.
Yes. Now, Silo Ridge is a community that we've had our eye on for a couple of years now, and it's up in Wasaic, New York, and you can take the train up there, you can drive, you can take your helicopter, and
as one does,
and you know, you can build a house there, you can buy a lot, or you can buy a condo in these buildings, which, like, to a layperson may look like a ski condo, but these are $3 or $4 million apartments in that ski condo, and they're on the golf course, and they've actually developed summer programming for families, because you know what they've found is most popular is the family stuff. You know, people love the golf and being there and being out in the outdoors, but also just like programming for kids is very valuable these days.
You also write in the Pursuit section, your team of journalists writes about a house made of bread. It's art, but it's going to cost you, and it's not even permanent because it's made of bread. Take us into it.
Right, exactly. How could a house made of bread be anything but art? So this coming week, we've got the return of Art Basel, which is the first biggest art fair that's returning after the pandemic.
Masked, vaccinated, right?
Yes, masked, vaccinated, and it's in Switzerland. The big hot thing is going to be bringing artists that collectors haven't been aware of or haven't been able to see in person for the past year and a half. And a lot of those people are painters. They appreciate a lot. They're very hot in the art market, and they have been for the past few years. But one gallerist is bringing an Urs Fischer sculpture, which is a giant house made of sourdough bread. And they're building it in the Unlimited section of Art Basel, which is where they have these big sort of immersive works. And if you buy it, it'll cost you around $3 million, and it comes with detailed instructions on how to rebuild it.
Right, you have to have artists come in, or bread sculptors come in, mm-hmm. which I didn't know until
reading
this was...
Bread house builders.
Bread house builders. I didn't know that was a thing. Mm-hmm, gingerbread house, yes. and actually maintain it.
Because it will rot. And that's part of the art, and you know, not a lot of people have room for that necessarily in their houses, but it was our favorite thing that we saw that was going to Art Basel.
So yeah, one of my favorite things in the magazine this week, and you got to check out a picture of it because it looks exactly like you would imagine a log cabin. Instead of being made of logs, it's made of loaves of sourdough.
Baguettes, and they're falling from the ceiling. It's really, it's a very active.
I was telling someone about this. Is it edible?
I think there is a lot. There's like a mortar that they made out of an organic material, but I don't know if it's like super edible. I don't know if you would want to.
Yeah, you know, don't eat the art is always a good.
Yeah,
unless it's a banana stuck to a wall, right?
Yeah, right, which you're supposed to.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk about a new hotel that is opening up in Paris.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite juxtapositions in the section. You turn the page from a house made of bread to the most fabulous hotel in Paris. Cheval Blanc is a resort chain owned by LVMH, and they had four resorts in like St. Moritz and in St. Barts, and now they've built one in a city. It's their first city project, and it's in this complex that LVMH bought right on the Seine overlooking the Eiffel Tower called the Samaritaine, and it was an old department store, and now they've spent 16 years, $900 million renovating it. Part of the new complex is a shopping center, very LVMH focused, and then part of it is this Cheval Blanc Hotel, and it was designed by Peter Marino, who does a lot of luxury stores. This is his first ever hotel, and it's just fabulous.
It has what's so special about it?
You know, the main thing that struck our couple of writers actually as they were touring around was almost every room has a balcony. So you have your room. It may cost $1,500 a night. It may cost a lot more. But you have your own private terrace, and you walk out, and it's like floating over the Seine. You're so close to the river. You have that great view of the Eiffel Tower. But also, you know, costumes. The uniforms of the staff are LVMH designed. The rooms smell, have a fragrance design from someone who worked at Dior Parfums. Like it just is super luxurious, and it has that great access to that great part of Paris.
Well, if you are going to be traveling, perhaps you're planning on going skiing or you're hitting the links on one of those new homes that you bought on a golf course, you're going to need some new gear. And there's an interesting story in the Pursuit section this week about a handful of LinkedIn executives who've gotten together to help make gear shopping easier. And it's not quite a bot. You're actually talking to former professional cyclists or golfers to help you get the right gear. Take us into it.
Yeah, so there's this website called Curated, and it helps you, as you said, buy sports gear, because a lot of what a lot of mistakes that people make is they buy the most expensive gear. You're like, okay, what's the best? I'm going to learn how to ski. What are the best skis? What are the best boots? And you know what? If you are learning how to ski, you don't want the best skis and right. You don't want the best boots. You don't want anything fast. You want things really generous with your turns. And so this one guy who was a LinkedIn executive actually made that mistake himself when he was trying to learn how to ski, bought way too expensive gear, had to turn it all in after his instructor was like, no, you need the basics. So Curated collects experts in all these different sports fields to help you find the equipment that's right for you. So again, you wouldn't want like a super elite set of golf clubs if you were starting. You want something with a generous sweet spot, you know, the right weight for you. So we had our writer go through and experiment with some of their experts to see what they recommended. And our writer is a ski writer. So he has tested thousands of skis. And when he was talking to the ski expert, the guy actually was like, okay, I have two recommendations for you, this pair and that pair. And one of them was the pair that was literally the writer's favorite pair of skis and the wow. one he skis on all the time. So they're pretty good. And so we recommend this service.
Interestingly enough, it was growing kind of slowly before the pandemic, as your team writes. But then the pandemic hit and people were thinking, wait a second, I need gear and I need to figure out what to buy.
Yeah, a lot of people were playing sort of socially distanced sports like skiing, like golf, like tennis, where the equipment actually really matters, and people were shopping online a lot more. So this was sort of their moment.
Well, speaking of equipment, there's a class of relatively new hardware that helps people try to relax and get to sleep. They're sort of headphones that you wear at night. Do we need these?
Do you need these? Well, I don't know if anyone needs this kind of device, but I will say if you're a grown-up and you've lived in the world, probably at various times you've been like, I wish that I had less stress and I wish I could fall asleep and stay asleep easier. And people try everything from melatonin to Headspace, the meditation app, to not having any screens in bed. Chances are you've tried all this stuff. And I got word of this device, which is called a Cove, and you wear it around your head. It's like it almost looks like headphones, but it actually contacts your head behind the skin behind your ears. And you wear it for 20 minutes every day, and it vibrates. Mm. And what it does is, what they say it does, is they say it sends these calming signals to your brain, which helps your brain better manage the connection between your brain and your body. And they call it interoception. And so when I first heard about it, I was like, this sounds like a bunch of baloney. Like,
yeah,
I've tried everything. I'll try it. And I tried it for almost 3 months now. And I actually found that it did help improve my sleep quality, and it did help my base level of stress during the day. I'm not a super stressed out person. But, you know, I thought it worked well enough that we should show it to our readers and have them give it a shot if they wanted.
$500.
It's $500. You have to have an app with it. I think if you're someone that has tried everything, and like a small but noticeable improvement in sleep quality would have an effect on your life, I think it is worth it.
All right. If you're having trouble falling asleep at the LVMH hotel in Paris.
Hopefully you're not.
Yeah, hopefully you're not. This one's
but
for
in
you.
Your bread house, you might be having some trouble.
That's true. It doesn't have great insulation when it comes to sound quality. Chris Rouser, editor of Pursuit Section. Check it out in the back of the book this week.
Thanks.
And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Tim Stenovic. Be sure to tune into our Bloomberg Business Week daily show. It airs Monday through Friday and starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News. Also, check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal. You can also see me at Bloomberg Quick Take, available on Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend. This is Bloomberg.